My ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky.
We don't expect everyone to like these wines, so yes, there's some risk.
Drink more sherry, because that's when you can really educate yourself on what happens in maturation.
The thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the aftertaste invariably is just bitter and unpalatable.
I think the Irish whisky landscape is going to be wildly different over the next 5 years.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits, and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. The Bird is a new single malt Australian whiskey created by renowned entrepreneur and media personality Mark Burris in collaboration with Andrew Nugent and Paul Giles of Adelaide Hills Winery Bird in Hand. Mark joins us this episode for what turned into quite a wide-ranging and insightful interview, starting with his personal journey of whiskey appreciation that inspired The Bird. We talk about the decision to produce the whisky in partnership with South Australia's Florio Distillery, which you may recall got a massive rap from Dave Worthington of Boutique Whisky in my March podcast news bulletin. Mark and I also touch on his previous involvement, and this was news to me, with a pioneering but ill-fated beer company 20 plus years ago now. We get his expert opinion on the nascent Australian craft spirits industry more broadly, and the challenges of selling luxury goods, which The Bird most definitely is, in the current economic climate. On that note, I should mention that this interview was conducted a few weeks ago now, before the RBA's latest interest rate rise that Mark has absolutely slammed today on social media. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Mark Burris. Well, Mark, thanks so much for joining us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
You're welcome.
I think just probably to kick off, how was The Bird conceived? Because it sort of came out of the blue for me, but have you had kind of a lifelong passion for whiskey?
I have. I personally have had a lifelong passion for whiskey. My father likes whiskey, and we've always liked whiskey together. In the old days when I used to travel overseas, like for work, I used to always buy my dad a bottle of whiskey at the duty free, and my dad started collecting whiskey. Dad and I love whiskey. My brother likes the whiskey. And I find it something great just to sit down. I'm not really a drinker, but just to sit down and have one whiskey or two whiskeys, it's a good conversation starter. It's a great leveler for me. And it was conceived when I was sitting down with about 7 years ago, sitting down with the guys, Paul Giles and Andrew Nugent from the Bird in Hand group. And I was with them at their winery, Cellar Door, actually, having lunch. And we're talking about their wines and all sort of stuff, because I've known them for a million years. We're drinking some of the wine. I just said, hey, guys, you know, I've always wanted to own my own whiskey brand. I used to own beer brands many years ago, and I was talking about that and how I sold out too early before the craft beer craze. And I said, you know, this time I wouldn't mind owning a whiskey brand and doing it properly. So, and then Andrew actually said, yeah, that'd be cool. I'd like to do that. And that's sort of where we conceived the idea.
I'm interested to know some of that backstory. I didn't know about your involvement in the beer industry, so can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, I was involved with some guys. We owned four or five brands. I can't remember. It's going back a while now, but one was...
Roughly what era are we talking about?
We're talking about early 2000s.
Yeah. Okay, so Little Creatures has just started.
It was around the same time, but probably the number one those days, craft beer was Coopers for us. It wasn't anywhere near what it is today. We owned five brands. Three of them we had produced in China. We had produced in China, some of which we exported to the US. Then we exported to Australia as well, or imported into Australia as well. And then two of the other brands we used to make down in Victoria in a brewery down there. You know, it was our formula, but they produced it. The reason I sold out is because for me, I was a smaller shareholder, but it was way too difficult when it came to excises and taxes and all that other stuff.
It was a tough business.
Tough business. And it was also very tough to distribute your product, because you have to get your beer out the front of the liquor stores, and the liquor stores had just been taken over by the big Woolworths and Coles and all those sorts of organisations. And to be at the front, you had to have a price. You had to sell it at a price, you know, and that price... For us, or for me at least, didn't make sense, because we had to be able to sell a case of beer at the front of the shop to get it to the front of the shop for $34 a case. We're going back a while. and when you added all the taxes and everything like that, that wasn't making any money, and I just didn't see any upside in that. I didn't realise that Australians were going to take to craft beer like they have.
Were these craft beer styles, or, you know, more traditional lager?
No, we had a lemon myrtle flavoured beer for using Australian.
Is this Barron's?
Yeah.
Oh, right. You were an investor in. Were you a founder of Barron's?
No, I was one of the. But I was one of the first investors after the founders.
Richard Adamson's a good mate of mine.
Yeah, the Barron's guys. Yeah,
we
and
Richard.
Yeah. So, yeah. And we had a little Buddha shaped. Beer. I don't know if you remember
Lucky.
That one.
Was it Lucky?
I can't remember. It was something like Lucky. Yeah. We had a few. And that was actually a cool little idea. It was great for Chinese, have with Chinese meal. It was a bit of a light flavoured beer and was good with Chinese spicy foods. All great ideas, but the margins are way too thin for someone like me.
Yeah, and you got out of it.
We got out.
Probably at the right time, to be fair, with what ended up happening.
Yeah,
with
they didn't go too well. I mean, I got away before the drama.
Yeah.
And I actually employed their PR girl. I mean, I had other businesses, so it wasn't like my life relied on it. I just thought it was a good idea at the time.
Yeah, it's funny, and, you know, I had no idea we were going to be talking about this, but I just look back at Barron's and sort of see, gee, what an opportunity. You know, you look at what Little Creatures sold to Lion for in the end. I mean, I think it might have been $300 or $400 million. Just pulled that number out of my head. And Barron's, it was around the branding I thought was good. The beers won trophies.
Totally.
There was a lot of potential there.
100%. And you're right, the marketing was very good, and that's why I employed the girl from the marketing department when things turned belly up. She actually turned to me and asked me, would I have a job? And I actually gave her a job straight away. But they were ahead of their time to some extent, but just totally underfunded. And you need really patient capital. And in those days, there was no backers. I mean, you couldn't go to a venture fund or venture capitalist. There weren't venture capitalists around, or if they were, they were remote.
And there was no previous example of a brewery that had grown to a scale and sold for an amount that would make it worth, that would interest a venture capitalist,
correct,
basically.
Correct. There was no baseline, and there was no proxy for what you could do to attract a venture capitalist. They were probably one of the first to sort of have a broad base of brands that they produced. But as I said, the margins are not there, and the distribution was very difficult. You know, to get into a pub would have been even harder. That's a big grind to get on the taps. You would have had to have a much bigger marketing budget, and you'd have to get on TV and all that sort of stuff to sort of tell everybody there's a reason why you should put that line into your hotel. I wouldn't call it a failure. It was an interesting experience for me. That's what sort of gave me the idea, well, I wouldn't mind sort of hanging out with these guys at Bird in Hand and producing this ourselves.
Fantastic. And how did you kind of settle on the model that you've gone with, which is, I believe, you've partnered with a great distillery down in South Australia,
Florio.
It's probably what you'd call the capital light model. You haven't set about building a distillery and then having to wait for years and years. Tell me about how that kind of evolved.
Paul Giles, who's the marketing guy from the Bird in Hand, we just sent him on a mission to find who's the best producer of whiskey. And he went everywhere. And we spent 6 to 8 months trying stuff, all of us like getting small bottles and, you know, tasting and talking about who could do the best deal for us and who had a good reputation, who could sort of guarantee supply. I mean, that's pretty important. And he came up with the Florio Distillery, which is down in Cape Florio in South Australia. It's a great, cool distillery, very interesting for us. Basically, what we decided to do was get him to produce it or distill it, and then we finished it off. And we were able to use the branding associated with, and also the reputation of the Bird in Hand and the quality of their barrels to finish off our first lot anyway. We're releasing some more in a couple of months. They've finished off the second lot as well. So we thought the two things worked together. And he was looking also for somebody who could sort of make big orders, as opposed to doing little cottagey sort of orders, and we're in that position to do that. And, of course, Andrew and the Bird in Hand are located in the Adelaide Hills, so it all made sense to us. We were pretty specific. We wanted single malt and single barrel, so we got both. We haven't sold any of the single barrel. We've kept all that.
So you've got a vatted release, which is like your core range whiskey, as it were.
Yeah.
The core range of one at this stage.
Yeah.
And then you'll release special barrels as you go along.
Over time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, we're not trying to, look, obviously we've got to make money out of it, but we're not really that pressed to make money. You know, we're okay with it. So we don't, you know.
It's a passion project, right?
More a passion project. We want to sell as much as we can. There's no sort of necessity, wow, we've got to run a gin a gin program as well to fund the whiskey, and we need to sell everything. We're lucky we sold pretty much everything in the of our first release, but we did hold back a lot. We held back as much as we released in our first go to market, which is probably was last year sometime. And we're about to go again. With this time, we've got a lot more to sell. And what we kept back was the single barrel stuff.
You know, you've mentioned about using the barrels at Bird in Hand, but in terms of the actual underlying whiskey, can you tell me anything more about the profile there that you got from Florio?
In terms of the tasting profile?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's all written down on here.
Okay.
and I'm not an expert on these things, but we try to get something more Japanese in style. So we wanted a sweet aftertaste or a sweeter lasting, lingering taste. We want something that's very drinkable. You know, people, mates of mine who tried it, they say it's very drinkable. It's actually very easy to drink the whole bottle, you know, with a couple of friends.
Yeah.
Because it's very drinkable. It doesn't leave, there's nothing heavy about it. And it's actually quite mellow. And we wanted it to be mellow like a conversation. Like we want it to be something that can accompany a conversation with your parent or your kids or your family or your best mate so that it doesn't take over. We're not looking for it to take over. So it's mild, it's got the same amount of alcohol as everything else, but it's mild to taste. It leaves a very pleasant aftertaste. We try to make it very drinkable. Is more, as I said earlier, we tried a lot of different whiskies, and my preference always has been Japanese style whiskies. I'm not interested in the peaty thing and the or anything. It's bit harsh. I'm interested in this type of whiskey in order to sort of relax the mood. We live in a pretty frantic world, and for me, anything that can put me in a mindset of being relaxed is really important to me. I don't drink to relax, but I like the drink to accompany my sense of relaxation. And that's sort of where we drove this in the beginning. The Florio guys they produce exactly what we wanted, and they will continue to produce that. Whether or not we decide to build our own distillery is another issue. It is probably something we will do. We're sort of hunting around locations at the moment, and I know that Andrew and Paul are currently even in Tasmania looking at various places. We have a property already not too far from Florio on the river in Adelaide, which is a rural property, where we are considering building our own distillery and maybe getting the Florio people to come in there with us. Because they are very good craftspeople.
Yes.
In terms of quality of whiskey. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We're happy with the quality of what we got now. We're happy with our formula. But now we've got to make sure that we put ourselves in a position where we have some sort of control of what we're producing.
I imagine you must have done a bit of due diligence on the whiskey industry in Australia and how it's evolved and all that kind of thing. What did you find when you started looking under the hood?
What? Lots of whiskies. I mean, a lot of people who are probably not commercially viable, who are doing it more with the hope of being commercially viable.
Out of passion, you know.
Because
they want to do it.
But money becomes important to them.
Of course.
Because whiskey, you've got to invest. Yeah. It takes 5-6 years to realise that investment. Mm. And depending on what sort of market you're realising into, you might not sell what you need to sell and or the price might be mispriced. And well, there might be 10 more coming out of the casks that are going to compete with you. And they might have bigger marketing budgets. One of the other things I noticed is not many of them have marketing budgets, in fact, very few. And I know because they come on my podcast and they're always hitting me up to come on my podcast. I have the OCD guys on there.
Yeah, I've had fantastic. Julie on my podcast too, actually.
Their whiskey is very good. Mm. But I know that the constraints on running these as businesses is quite large in terms of time and capital that's required to maintain them. And then you run off and start doing gin to sort of supplement the program. It becomes full time. So that's what I noticed. I noticed that everybody's out there trying to work out a solution or a business model that surrounds producing their passion project. We're really lucky. We all have other businesses support us and we're doing this just for passion, just because we want to. It doesn't mean we're not being commercially minded. We have commerce at all stages in our mind, but we don't sort of suffer from the same constraint. So we can go slow or fast or bulk up or slow back down or whatever the case may be. We don't spend any money in marketing at this stage. We haven't had to. I mean,
You've got a good following.
You've got a good profile.
Yeah, so has that been how – has it sort of just sold
basically
organically
sold.
Yeah. through that
yeah,
so
yeah.
far?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, I can do stunts with people. Like I can get big name people to come in and try it and muck around. I've sent a couple of them a bottle, and you know, they put it up on their Instagram or whatever the case may be. But that helps. But it's a tough business. I think that's probably what I found out. I mean, someone like Sullivan's don't matter because they just email you out and they've established themselves as one of the world's best, blah, blah, blah. Mind you, there's lots of world's best, but in every category, wine, beer, whatever you want to talk about. But still, it's not a bad selling point, and they price into that marketing brand, that brand. But I don't think their marketing is all that particularly fantastic. I mean, the whiskey's good, but the marketing's not all that fantastic, and they tend to sell out every time. They have this ability to email you and sort of push you in a position, because I'm on their emailing list, I'm going to buy Sullivan's. They put you in this email list and pretty much tell you if you don't buy now, you're going to miss out. And they're good at getting that edge on you, but they're about the best at doing it. Yeah. I'd say they're the best.
And not everyone can have that model, you know.
No, totally. Yeah. So it's all about chasing the whiskey commercial model that best works in order to give you a sustainable life in this game.
You've come in with a very premium price product. I think it's $199 for a 500.
$200, yeah.
$200 for a 500ml bottle. Tell me, why are you able to command that price?
I don't know the answer to that. We did. question is, will we be able to maintain that price?
Yeah. I suppose, you know, the economy's changed as well.
Totally.
Since well, it's not a great environment for luxury goods right now.
We sold out. Well, that's a funny thing. We sold out our first run. But we're not talking about 10,000 or anything like that. But we sold it on our first run, which was good. I think it's fair to say that luxury won't sell to those people who are those people who, during, for example, COVID period, decided to spoil themselves because they couldn't go to a restaurant. There were a lot of people who did that, and I don't think that's not the market we talk to. We're talking to those people who maybe don't have debt, cash free. There could be someone from 20 to 30. Good job. Aspirational, or it could be someone who's paid down their debt and is, you know, 50 plus and is looking to try something Australian and try something new that they haven't tried before. And then hopefully they like enough, like I like Sullivan's, and I keep buying it. So we're not producing 50,000 bottles or even 10,000. We're not producing that much. We only need to get a couple of thousand of these individuals. And if you look at the demographics in Australia, which I mean, I'm always doing in my other businesses, there is a lot of people still buy luxury. And even during tough times, people luxuriate themselves. And those luxury people are paying $900 for a bottle of Sullivan's or $800. The question is, will they give this a crack? And if they're any good at it, they'll try this against the other more expensive brands. And you might say they'll always have, when this is run down, they'll get another bottle. And I'm saying they're not going to go and buy a bottle a week. You know, and we're not expecting to sell this out of a lot of bars, although we do have this in a few whiskey bars, but we're not expecting to sell a lot of it because there's about 1,000 choices in those joints. Our model is to sell towards the really luxury end, but not tip it over to $240, $250, $300 a bottle at $200. We chose that number quite carefully. So far, we haven't seen any resistance. I live in a sort of that world, to be frank with you. So do the Bird and Hand guys, and still sell a lot of Bird's Nest. They sell the cheaper versions of their wine as well, but they still sell a lot of Bird's Nest, which is the more expensive stuff. So we'll see if our thesis is correct or not, but we're not trying to sell too much. If we don't need to sell it all, we just keep it. And at some stage, we're going to have 12-year-old whiskey, and we're going to have 20-year-old whiskey, and a 20-year-old Australian whiskey. It's a long game for us. At the same time, we do want to sell. It'd be great if we could sell enough on every run to pay whatever we've put into it for that particular run. And there's a reasonable profit margin. It's not like the beer business and the Baron stuff, but it's a reasonable profit.
Tell me about what thought went into the packaging, because it's obviously something that's quite striking, quite minimal as well. Is that sort of an expression of your taste?
Yeah, it is pretty much. I mean, I'm not a fancy guy, nor the other two. We designed this during COVID, the bottle, the cork, the stamp, the logos and everything like that. And to be frank with you, it probably took, because we weren't traveling, so we had to send stuff, photographs, emails. I found bottles that I liked. Paul and Andrew found bottles that they liked, and you know, it took forever to work out what the logo looked like. The bird obviously has two references. One of the references is to irreverence. In other words, you give someone the bird.
Yeah, I thought of that actually.
That's my point of view. Yeah. From their point of view, obviously, it's a reference back to the bird in hand.
Yeah,
for obvious reasons. So we thought the bird actually had a good Australian point of view. The design of the bird, we wanted something very simple. Now, the bird has a lot of significance. Andrew and Paul are very heavily enamoured with Indigenous culture in Adelaide, and they have a heavy investment in Indigenous culture. And the bird, of course, is a big deal in Indigenous cultures. In fact, most cultures, birds have particular significance. This bird, we tried to design it in a graphic sense, in such a way that it was at once is very simple, but also it looked like it was taking off. But we wanted it to be modern and futuristic. Mm. We weren't looking for an old school whisky. We're trying to pretend that we've been around for 100 years, and someone with a walking stick or along those lines. But, we
pretending to be Scottish.
Correct. Yeah. We wanted to be Australian. We do like the reference back to Indigenous and the way they look after the land and how they are exceptional at in their agricultural practices. And Andrew, of course, is an ag scientist, a great student of Indigenous agricultural practices, particularly being a grape grower. And we become really interested in grains, and particularly more native grains, and the concept of country and how you have to look after country and how you have to continually sort of recycle. And we're thinking about at some stage, perhaps with the blessing of the Indigenous community that we operate out of, perhaps we're even putting together a whisky that is made from Indigenous grains or native grains. But basically in order to dip our hat to our Indigenous friends. And that's a big project from Andrew's point of view and Paul's point of view and mine. And they've introduced me to this whole concept, and I find it quite fascinating. And probably most important thing I found really fascinating is just learning about what Indigenous or First Australians have done and continue to do in relation to agricultural practices when it comes to production of anything that we consume. It's been quite fascinating, and we will do something in due course, like special runs of these things. We're not doing it again to make money. We're doing it to sort of pay respect to our Indigenous First Nations people.
Do you see that the bird might have a stable mate or two in your core range ultimately, or is it just going to be the bird and then special release products?
Probably more the special releases. And we just stick to our lane. And obviously we have the single barrel, which is slightly different, but we haven't released any of that. But single malt whiskies produced down in South Australia near the sea. We quite like the fact that, there's a bit of saltiness in the taste, and I'll leave this bottle with you to consume at your leisure.
Thank you.
And I'd be interested to hear what you say and think about it. One of the things that we've made a big deal of is the gift box. So we have a gift box here, which I'll just grab. It has, when you open it up, the whiskey normally just sits in here, and there's a tasting notes sticker inside, which we normally have, so people can talk about it when they're trying the whiskey. And we think that's important because it's all about talking points. The bird would normally sit in there. We deliver it to you. We prepare for Father's Day. So we do Father's Day runs. We do Christmas runs. We sold a lot during Christmas time because it's a perfect gift. If you've got a dad or a brother or a colleague or whatever, uncle, it's a great gift. $200, boxed, wrapped with a card, and we deliver it. We deliver it to your home. So we went hard after the gift market. It's one of those gifts you give to somebody who has everything. What are we going to give this person? This gift lasts for a long time. Most people don't drink it in a weekend. Some do, but sometimes this will sit on a shelf maybe for 9 months or even a year. And when you go back, so it's that enduring benefit that we try to create.
It's an ornament as well.
It is an ornament.
I heard someone describe it to me as being like a coffee table book or an ornament. You've got to deliver on that level of quality of packaging.
That's what, and the whiskey has to be that quality too.
Yeah.
So to answer your earlier question, we decided to go with a bottle that looks like this. We have a stamp, an embossed stamp on the lid. We went through all sorts of drama trying to get the cork, and the corks didn't fit, and of course of COVID, and then there was you couldn't get corks out of Portugal, which we were sending to China to get the lid made. It was just a nightmare for about a year there. It put us back a year, actually. But nonetheless, we got there eventually. And so the whole program was about making something very drinkable, high quality, priced where we thought a good gift would be priced, well boxed, and delivered to whoever needs it. You can buy them, by the way. There are some Dan Murphy franchises in Adelaide. You can buy this now. Dan Murphy's not releasing across the board. We just select a few Dan Murphys where this is a more an affordable item. It might be Dan Murphy's in Vaucluse, if there was one. those sorts of Dan Murphy's there. Yeah, we get great feedback from it. To everybody who I know who's a whiskey drinker, give it big raps. When we finally decided on which whiskey we're going to go with, of that was distilled, that we got to try, and we, so many iterations, we ended up, when we finally bottled it, we got a panel of whiskey judges who we know are actual judges and said to them, what do you think? And we came back with a really good report. Now, that's a really technical outcome, but we thought if we could at least pass muster with judges who are normally judging these things in actual competitions, then we're a half a chance. So we've got technical people telling us they're very good, technical judges, probably appointed judges, and also our friends. But most of our friends love a good whiskey.
What's your sort of day-to-day involvement? You're obviously very busy with your other businesses, but is the bird consuming much time for you during the week?
Well, not at the moment because it's distilled and bottled down in Adelaide. So, I mean, it's more business as usual for them down there. But we do meet. Like I saw Andrew and Paul came to Sydney last week and we had lunch, spending a couple of hours talking about it. Andrew and Paul are they were in Tasmania, I don't know if they still are today, but they were sending me photographs of stuff they're doing. So, yeah, pretty hands-on. When it comes to marketing, where my team do all the photography and do all the content, my mentor team, we help them conceive marketing ideas. Bill marketing ideas. I'm here talking to you on your podcast. I've been on a few other podcasts. Andrew's a pretty quiet guy. Like, he's not really all that public facing or consumer facing guy. He does do some interviews in Adelaide, etc. He's not. He's more the scientist behind everything. Andrew and Paul's the marketing guy from Bird in Hand. So, and Paul's role in all this, he's one of the shareholders. But Paul's role in all this is to make sure everything gets produced at the price that we, or the budget we agreed. So I would speak to him once a week, sometimes just by text, and then I'll respond to text. Like, I get up to sales updates at the beginning of every week from the previous week. We've got a cellar door at the Bird in Hand as well, where we sell the whiskey. There's probably not much to do at the moment, but every time there's a tactical or a strategic decision to be made, all three of us get involved. Yeah. I love it. I mean, it's a distraction for me from my other businesses, which are consuming me, especially during interest rate periods like we're going through now with the Yellow Brick Road. So I find this a relief. I look forward to it. It's fun. It's even the mental business has now turned into a full-on business, like, you know, like advertisers and expectations, and you've got to do so many podcasts a week and blah, blah, blah.
The feeling.
Yeah, you know, originally it was sort of a pastime, but yeah. Then it's got staff and, you know, all the usual things. So to me, this is a real joy and a great relief. And it's outside of my normal area. So I'm learning about it. And what I learn, like, in terms of the whiskey, the bottle, the distribution, the marketing, the issues about supply chains, you know, the designs, it's been fun, been really cool.
We've already touched on the difficult economic conditions at the moment, and I know in, you know, my sector, the drinks industry, we've had a few insolvencies, and from what I've heard anecdotally, quite a few businesses teetering on the edge. It's a really difficult time.
I get capital.
Yes. Do you have any top line kind of tips for any of the producers that might be listening in terms of how to survive this kind of market?
It's about long-term survival or medium-term survival. I think you've got to try and forget about the short term because you can't influence the short term. You can influence your own behaviour during the short term, but you can't influence what is happening. One of the things I know is that downturns in the availability of capital to invest in your business, or downturns that affect consumers from maybe buying whiskey or spending money on a bottle of wine, they might just decide they're not going to drink wine for a while they pay their mortgage. Downturns only last in Australia between 9 and 15 months. So you'd have to consider we're already probably 6 months into it. Let's say this is going to be a longer one because we come out of an extraordinary period of growth. So let's say it goes 15 months. Let's say it goes for 18 months. So that means you've got to buckle down for the next 9 months, because one thing that happens is this stuff's all cyclical. At some stage, what's going on with the Reserve Bank, they'll bust it. They'll bust us. They'll create a recession. They won't admit that's what they're trying to do, but that's what they'll do. It'll create a recession or a downturn. It doesn't even have to be technically a recession, but they'll create a downturn. The downturn will start to put the job numbers up to, they're already predicting 4.5, but let's say it could get to 5% unemployment. As a result of that, people lose their jobs and our growth gets a bit low. Australia's growth gets low. And what happens is the Reserve Bank goes, oh, wow, I have to put interest rate down. And at that point, we go back to the old cycle, the other way, the cycle, and there'll be an interest rate reduction period. Already the commentators are predicting, some commentators are predicting an interest rate reduction at the end of this calendar year. Others are sort of saying February, March next year, which is no big deal. But once that reduction in interest rates starts to occur, people will open up their shoulders and start to buy again, but slowly. So my thesis is that...
keep your chin up.
Do whatever you can to maintain your business. Yeah. Don't drop your guard. Start spending less on other things. If the business means a lot to you, spend less on other things and just ride it out, because that's what you have to do. The ones who survive these environments are the ones who ride it out. It doesn't mean you've got a lot of money. It just means that you cut costs wherever you can and chase whatever other revenue sources you possibly can chase, whatever they might be. It doesn't matter what they are. Get a job somewhere else. Get a second job. I mean, one of the great things was unemployment's only 3.5%. So people are desperate to employ people at the moment. So, you know, even if you do something that for a fee that you would not normally do it for, if you would only normally do it for $2,000, but someone says, I only got 500, do it for 500. Because they're all the things you do to survive during this down period. And it's not going to be forever. It will change. When it changes, it'll go the other way. All of a sudden people go, wow, interest rates coming back. I've got to buy a property. I'm going to, buy a fridge that has a wine cabinet in it, or I'm going to, these are the things that happen every single time. I've seen it so many times in the last 40 years, 47 years. It's mind-boggling. It's always as stressful, but it's mind-boggling how quickly it turns back.
But it seems like you have a real perspective on things that you wouldn't have had earlier in your career.
Totally.
You've seen this probably freak out a lot easier earlier in your career when you haven't kind of seen
it. I certainly did. I mean, I made drastic decisions, like to sell my house in the early 90s. I mean, I made a decision. I got nervous. I sold my house. I was married with kids and little kids. And my view on it is just the better you are at hanging in there and the more suffering you put up with and the more compromises you make and the more sacrifices you make, the more likely that you'll survive this downturn period and then you'll do really well in the upturn period. So that's the key. And if you're a wine producer or a gin producer or a whiskey producer or a beer producer, whatever it is, hang in there because consumers will come back.
Great advice. Well, before I let you go, because I know you've got to get on your way, how's the podcast going? I always like to talk shop with a fellow podcaster.
No, I've got, I do the Mentor Bot podcast, which is growing quite well. And, our listenership is very good. We support it with a lot of stuff. Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube is amazing what we support it with. And then we have the Straight Talk podcast, which is pretty cool, bit of fun, more Joe Rogan style. I mean, I talk to all sorts of unusual characters from porn stars to criminals to sports stars to footy coaches to scientists, all sorts of people coming in there. That's doing very well. I mean, I think we're number 7 in Canada, number 7 in the UK, either number 2 or 3 in Australia. We hit number 1 at one stage there, but we got back down to 2 or 3. Yeah, it's doing really well. Both podcasts are doing well. Not because of me. I spend very little time doing it. I might spend an hour on both. Most of it, my team spend all the time, as you know, editing. That's the long, boring, tedious, hard part. So they've got to try and make me sound like I know what I'm talking about and make sure my voice is clear and I'm not mumbling too much.
Yeah. For sure. Cool. Well, thanks so much for coming out to my humble abode for interview on the Drinks Adventures podcast. Been really interesting hearing about the whiskey, and I can't wait to taste it, which I'll be doing very soon. So thanks, Mark.
Good luck to you. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.